Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special edition of Digital Shadows and ReliaQuest Shadow Talk podcast. Today, we are joined by the host of one of our great partners, Set Solutions podcast, Ready, Set, Secure. We have Michael Farnham and Greg Porterfield with us today.
How you doing, Rick?
Good.
Thanks for having us.
Glad we finally got this taken care of.
Yeah, this is good stuff. We finally got it set up. So we are on episode 48 of Ready, Set, Secure, Set Solutions podcast. As usual, got Greg Porterfield, who is a co-host and usually locked in his room because he's tied to IP addresses and that kind of stuff because he's doing some kind of pen test. So how you doing, Greg?
I'm doing well. It is an interesting day today.
Well, we need to have a beer and talk about that. That's not a very interesting.
Well, one thing, you know, I always like to talk to guests or co-host, as this is a three host episode. What's your origin story? Maybe I'll give a little bit of mine as well after for your listeners.
Yeah, that would be good. So origin story for our listeners, they've heard it a bunch, but for your listeners, been in the IT and cybersecurity world since I think 1994 was my first role. Moved over into pure security about 99. And then moved over into the pre-sales world along with you, actually, mm-hmm. part of your origin story when we were back in the Accuvant days. And been doing that since about 2007. Joined over here at Set Solutions in 2000. Oh my gosh, it's 2017, I guess now. So about almost 5 years. And about 2010, along with all the stuff I do as a day job, I started HUSETCon, Houston Security Conference, and have been doing that since 2010. That's coming up in October. That's a passion project, nonprofit, 501c3. Don't make any money or anything off of it. We just do it to help educate Houston area cybersecurity folks, but a lot of people from all over Texas come down for it as well. You've been there before, spoken there mm-hmm. before. So yeah, that's me. In a nutshell.
And Greg?
My background, I started some years back as a developer. I was writing code, got me kind of interested in all of the different aspects. So I have seen development operations, kind of monitoring and gathering up data, Splunk and things like that. Relatively new to kind of the security focus, but I've been close to it for a very long time. I guess it's a year and a half now. Switched over to offensive security and doing pen testing as part of the day job. So I spend most of my time either researching, reading, or learning about how this attacks and things are working, and then trying to figure out how that can be used to help customers get better at mitigating these attacks or at least see them coming. So I have a kind of a large amount of different things that I have done, which makes it kind of interesting to see it from a security perspective.
Yeah, you've got a lot of different lenses on the problem, mm-hmm. and maybe not the same lens that most of the people in the security space have, which is actually something we talk about on Shadow Talk quite a bit, is diversity mm-hmm. and people with different backgrounds, religions, sexes, races, et cetera, and just gives you that. For the set, listeners, you know, I am the Chief Information Security Officer at Digital Shadows. We were acquired by ReliaQuest over the summer. I run the threat intelligence team here at Digital Shadows. Prior to this, I was at Forrester Research. I was there 4.5 years as an analyst, created the threat intelligence research there. And then I know Michael and many folks at SET from my time at Accuvant as a sales engineer. Interestingly enough, I am a customer of Set Solutions now from a security perspective. And then before that, I was in the Army, actually, like Michael as well, just a few years after he joined. So yeah, we should have a good discussion today. For the listeners, we thought we'd dig into the news of the week, the soup du jour, which would be the Uber intrusion. So I thought I'd give a little bit of background on that. Latest news on what is very much an emerging story. In fact, by the time we publish this, we're recording it on Tuesday, there may be new information that comes out. So yep. Think about that timestamp for this recording. And then we'll kind of talk about takeaways, and then we'll kind of move into some 2023 planning, and then we'll wrap up with some promotion, how people can reach you, listen to your podcast, and that sort of thing. But to set the stage, on Thursday last week, the New York Times reported that Uber suffered a breach. The article was titled "Uber Investigating Breach of Its Computer Systems." Uber acknowledged it on their blog site, their press room blog site, Thursday night. They gave another small update on Friday, but then on Monday, the 19th, they gave a much more detailed update on what had occurred. But essentially, Uber stated that a contractor's account was compromised, and that it was likely attacker purchased the credentials on the dark web, which is actually something Digital Shadows is quite focused on in general. And then the adversary somehow socially engineered this contractor person and then gained access to the environment. And then once they got into the environment, they did their typical lateral movement. It's been reported in social media that they found some PowerShell scripts that basically had, you know, keys to the kingdom there. And then they ended up putting messages on Slack to all employees, and there's screenshots on social media of that. But it was a pretty significant intrusion for what we know today. But again, it's an emerging story. Uber Monday said that it was Lapsus, which is an interesting extortion crew that we've tracked for quite some time. They originally started targeting in South America, Portuguese speaking members of that group. We've seen an arrest in the UK in the past 6 months for Lapsus as well. And then, of course, Lapsus has been involved in targeting Microsoft, NVIDIA, Samsung, T-Mobile, Grand Theft Auto, most recently following after this one for all the gamers that are out there. So that's kind of where we're at today. I don't know. Is there any other information that you guys have seen in the, you know, today that adds to the story or the narrative?
I think Lapsus was the kind of the newest one that came out. I mean, a lot have been around the 2FA, MFA weaknesses, and we're going to get into that, I think, a little bit. Again, there may be new info that comes out by the time we put this out, but I think Lapsus was the most recent one that I saw, which is, I mean, interesting in and of itself, because Lapsus has pivoted from going from South America to going after some of these big players and become a big dog in that world. They're not playing around going after Uber. I mean, this, even some of the bigger ones, this is really an indication of them going extremely hard against some of these big monsters and trying to do some real damage.
Greg, I think the biggest part so far that I've seen, the combination with Lapsus and the Grand Theft Auto part that I saw kind of strung together this morning, is the kind of velocity. There's not a lot of break in between things. They are running multi kind of pronged things. There's no connection between one to the other, but two things happen in relatively short order. That was surprising. And then the kind of public bragging is a little bit out of character, not necessarily for them, but it's the pretty name and shame up first. Usually we get to find out other ways, not, you know, screenshots of the infrastructures and things like that to start peering into so fast.
Yeah, from an extortion perspective, you know, they seem to be more in it for the lulz yes, than some of the other groups that are out there, and versus, you know, Lockbit's site where they'll announce their victims there, and the victims can repatriate their data, if you will. I wouldn't trust that from there, but Lapsus is quite different. They're very good at social engineering. They do, and that occurred reportedly in this case as well. And then yes, they're definitely in for the fun, maybe a little bit of money as well. But it's a different type of extortion crew than what we've seen, you know, over the past 24 months or so, when we've had all the extortion activity that's been going on.
It's nice to see they're building some efficiency in their operations, you know, but I guess supposedly the same kid did Rockstar and Uber, right?
Well, it's a collective. I mean, it's a group of actors.
Yeah, but he seems like he was one that was up front about
Teapot.
Yeah.
Um, But I do think the pace of it is quite significant. In fact, there was initially when the Russia-Ukraine war popped off in the spring, like I remember going into the Friday weekend, I don't know if it was Hitachi. There was a couple that were targeted. And I think originally people thought, oh, this is Russian, you know, retaliation against Western countries, but that never came to fruition and being confirmed. But as the two of you look at this and, you know, kind of we set the stage, like, what are some of the lessons that you think security practitioners and security leaders should take away?
The biggest one for me, I mean, everybody wants to look at MFA, that kind of thing. But if you follow at least what the initial news was and how they were getting access into some of these and using actual tools that are made for security purposes, for cybersecurity purposes, I've always talked to my customers about, hey, anytime you buy, it's one of the reasons we try to keep them from buying too many things and, you know, putting kind of keeping their group of tools and products that they have to a minimum is because every time you buy something like this, you actually add to your attack surface. And people don't think about that from a security tool. They just, I don't think it's any security tools are claiming this necessarily. It's just a mindset. Hey, I'm buying a security tool. Therefore that tool is secure. So when you have them attacking things like 2FA and MFA, it's the products themselves and then the way they're used. You have to think about those as you're implementing them. What are the processes that you're putting in place to use these? How do you put limits on maybe so many different alerts coming out from your MFA tool on, you know, trying to get somebody to click on a button? I mean, maybe there's some limitations you need to set, or maybe there's something in your logs that you should go, hey, look, I'm seeing 100 of these things come out. We're probably being attacked. We need to lay this alert out to everybody. It's things like that. Thinking about the actual implementation and how the use of these cybersecurity tools are used. And if they're adding, or they are adding to your attack surface, how do you make sure those are secure? I know that's something we kind of want to get into in the what's 2023 look like type of thing, but I think it leads into that discussion. You have to look at those tools very closely, just as you do anything else.
I think there's a lot of lessons to this one. The first one that kind of occurred to me when I saw before I went to bed that night was, if it was an alert fatigue or MFA prompt fatigue, as it was, the education around why MFA two-factor, the security protocols are put in place, has to extend to the why and what of what should a person do when their phone is blowing up? If you're getting an alert, you know, if it's a social engineering and they just kind of randomly put things in, you can end up making the mistake of, how do I respond to this other than turn my phone off and try and reach out to, you know, my local support or my leadership or anything like that. But people have to understand how those things can be used against them of sooner or later, the kind of frustration does build and people have to know, like, it's okay, just turn it off, you know, text your boss, whatever, of this is going on. Someone had to be made aware that those things are going on. The other side was that they got too far, way too fast. It was probably a surprise that they found the PowerShell scripts and the other kind of keys to the kingdom when they were in. But those are the kind of basics and fundamentals of what can be seen on your network from an attacker's perspective. What could someone find? And those are usually specific to an organization, but it's also something that they should be looking for actively and proactively of, you know, just let people wander around the network, see what they come up with, and then lock those things down from clean perspectives of too many assumptions get made of, oh, well, they can't see it, or they won't find that network share, or, you know, it's not going to be hiding in group policy. Those things have to be fresh eyes pretty frequently.
Two things that stood out for me or initial reactions is, one is Uber situation is probably very similar to most of the companies that we interact with. Complicated networks to defend, you know, MFA in place for some organizations. Many don't even have, you know, even SMS-based authentication in place. And we can talk about that a little bit more. So I definitely think, and I don't know that I've seen it, but no dancing on graves, no, you know, yeah. those who live in glass houses type of thing with Uber. Because I look at the companies, if this was in fact Lapsus, and I wonder if law enforcement was involved there, because they didn't say how they came up with the attribution that it was Lapsus per se. But Lapsus is a target, some of the biggest brands globally in the world, right? So, you know, anyone could be in a very similar situation. So I think that's one, is you're probably a lot more similar to this environment than, you know, being different from it. The other is, and I haven't seen this, but you historically, you'll see on the Twitterverse, people love to blame the users. I don't even like to use the term user. I think it's a derogatory term, the way a lot of times IT and security folks will say users. You know, there are colleagues, there are peers, there are customers, partners, that sort of thing. So, you know, I think we need to be setting up security solutions that enable our employees and colleagues to make the right decisions in a transparent, frictionless way. Now, of course, what I just said there is kind of nirvana, right?
I was about to say that exact word, nirvana. Nerdvana.
It is definitely in that route, but I don't think we should be naming and shaming employees that are just trying to get their jobs done.
Well, I mean, it goes back to the conversations you and I used to have back in the day when, you know, phishing your users first became a thing. It's like, well, this seems kind of abusive. And I actually was talking to I did a talk last week at a little conference in Houston. And one of the things somebody in the audience talked about, because it's kind of a fireside chat, they talked about how their company was extremely, they basically punished.
Oh, punitive.
Punitive. I had the first few letters. They were very punitive in how they approached security in their organization, both physical and cybersecurity. And it, to me these days, it's like with all these people jumping jobs and moving over to the place, I'm not going to stay in an environment where I feel like I'm abused. Educate me, please. Let me, you know, what's happening. And I'm not necessarily against trying to teach lessons, but it needs to be a positive type of a lesson, and that people need to
carrot,
know.
Not a stick.
Exactly. beating people up like that on Twitter. I mean, I don't see as a, I know it can be used as a derogatory term, but it, you know, the whole moniker of stupid user, stupid user, stupid user got, you need empathy more than you need that kind of rancor. It just doesn't make any sense today.
We also have to figure out at the implementation, the first thing, any type of MFA, any type of platform that's put into an environment, from my previous jobs and things like this, as we were rolling in new tools, we were figuring out what data we could get from them. And that was usually first of our list of, if we were going to roll multi-factor in, or we're going to put password vaults in place and these kinds of things, it was, how do we know what it's being used for? Could we detect, or what can we detect about how it's being used, and what metrics can we get so that we could light up dashboards for our SOC or for the network or our security teams of, you know, this is what a baseline looks like, so that when something goes wrong, we know how to reference it. Many of the times those pieces are included, but they have to be kind of part of that implementation. It's not just drop the tool in. It's not just configure your URLs to point to some new authentication or integrating the new package, but also collecting that information and then publicizing it. This is what things are going to look like. This is what our baseline for the number of requests looks like, and have the alerts ready to go and tested. We should never, much like a phishing exercise, the fact that someone will eventually click on that is a given. Someone will eventually get social engineered. Protecting the environment from one user being compromised is paramount. If one machine being compromised or one account being compromised leads to this level of problems, that's kind of a failing on the security side of why were those so many pieces let to be that way? What other protections could have been put in place so that that account either locked down because of too many MFA requests, or once they started reaching into the network in places where they weren't, why wasn't any of that picked up faster? So, and it's still, it's always complicated. It's never as easy as, oh, we just, you know, run the search and here we go.
It's so easy to Monday morning quarterback breaches of other companies. It can be dangerous.
Well, I mean, yes. Think of an environment of that. I mean, Uber obviously has a decently complicated environment, but at the same time, that's a company that's solely focused on doing one thing, delivering one service, right? I mean, I know there's a lot that goes into that service, but when you talk about some of our other customers who've got environments that are ridiculously complicated, and one implementation of MFA in one spot is absolutely not going to work in an environment like a company that's got OT, it's not going to work. Naming and blaming and all of that stuff, when you've got that kind of complicated of an environment and you're trying to implement something like this, it doesn't do any good to be telling somebody who's a blue collar worker who hasn't worked in the IT space, who's just trying to keep things going so you still get water at your house, you shouldn't have clicked on that thing. I mean, it's just like, you know, put stuff in place that helps them not have to worry about those decisions as much. They still have to have the mindset of security, but you can't be beating them about the head and shoulders. So
one of the other things that stands out for me is this false sense of security around MFA in general. And some of it goes back to what you said, Greg, is, you know, implementing best practices, maybe even doing a professional services engagement to bring someone in and do a health check on your Okta, on your Duo, on your Ping implementation. And maybe doing that, you know, once a year or something along those lines to make sure that you're properly configured. Because on MFA, I mean, we know the SMS-based authentication, I mean, it's better than nothing, but it's barely better than nothing. You know, we've done research at Digital Shadows on SIM swapping. So people were able to get in the middle there and, you know, get that code and then get access there. And then you have the adversary in the middle phishing where they're going after the session tokens. And Microsoft put a really nice piece of research out, I don't know, maybe 6 to 8 weeks ago, where they found a reporting on an adversary in the middle campaign for phishing that targeted like 10,000 organizations. So, you know, our traditional approach, I mean, some MFA is better than no MFA. That might help with bottom feeders and noise. But if someone is targeting your organization, a little bit more sophisticated of a threat actor, you're going to need to have, you know, something that goes beyond into FIDO UTF or FIDO 2 if you're going on a passwordless journey. And I'd be curious what you guys see on this. Like if you go with the UTF, right, you have a token. Could be a YubiKey, it could be NFC on a mobile device. But one of the pushbacks, you know, is user experience. I just said user, right? I guess it is called UX though.
It is. Yeah, you're not going to get rid of it.
But is the experience the employees have, you know, or if they lose a YubiKey and what that means to them? Do you see your customers, you know, going down this UTF route, YubiKey route, or passwordless with FIDO 2?
We do see some of them going there. There's definitely some interest, I would say, in passwordless. Implementation has not been strong yet. It's been more of an investigation. We've got some POCs going on with different companies that offer the passwordless. We've got a couple of vendors that are very focused on doing nothing but passwordless. And then we've got others who are an identity access management across the board who are implementing it as a new feature in their platform. So I think we're at this weird stage where customers are trying to figure that out and which one do they go after. It's like anything in the cybersecurity world, you've always got a vendor who has created a feature ultimately that ends up putting it into a larger product. That's not talking bad about them. That's just where they start.
It's the nature of the
evolution.
New companies, right?
So there, that's definitely starting to happen. The YubiKey, I mean, I straight up, I had a YubiKey that I played, you know, I've used one for years. And then I was playing with one specifically for a certain environment, like a social media environment. I was just playing with it to test out some new functionality that I was playing with. And I lost the key. So I had to go through a whole process.
And you're tech savvy.
And I'm tech savvy.
Ish.
Yeah. I mean, I literally put the thing on my keychain and then I took it off for some reason and then was like, oh, well, crap. Now I've got to go through this whole process of recovering this thing. Same thing with like a password manager. Imagine having that tied to it. I mean, like LastPass, speaking of breaches, other companies like that, when they have, when you have that tied to it and you lose that, you can possibly lose your entire world.
I can't imagine if I lost my one password vault.
Exactly. Right. What do you do? So those are the kind of things that we caution them with. Like, look, you need to make sure you've got a definite, but a something of a strong recovery process. And then, but of course, then when you do that, you've got to worry about that, because if that is susceptible to being hacked, that recovery process, you know, it's like everything else. You've got to balance the, how easy is this to do, so I'm not making all my users mad, to how difficult is this, because I need to make sure it's not easily hacked, so anybody can get in anybody's vault. So that's really the discussions we're having with a lot of our customers now, is that you need to do both of these things. We've got some customers that, honestly, because of who we deal with in some aspects in the oil and gas, where they're a little bit behind those things in energy, sometimes they're just now getting to where they're doing a good job at identity and access management in some areas of their organization. So adding this other stuff, they're like, look, I'm not ready for that yet. So yeah, it's, we're getting there. We're having the conversations. We got some people doing POCs. I don't know of a full blown passwordless implementation within our customer base. Obviously that's anecdotal.
Your mileage may vary.
Others are going to do it. So it's out there, but it's still pretty brand new, right? So
I see multi-factor at the applications tier pretty effectively. I haven't seen yet an environment. We haven't been put into an environment where we have kind of good next level of, whether it's passwordless or soft keys and or hardware tokens. That hasn't been a thing yet. I suspect over time we'll start seeing a tier to protect, you know, whether it's executives or the kind of administrators that have the keys to the kingdom.
If you didn't say it, Greg, I was going to say that's where to start out, I think, on the journey is, although I don't know if I'd start with executives.
I think you can find the experience pretty effectively there of how can we make this frictionless, because while executives are fine, they have the least tolerance, in my experience, with anything in the way. So if you can make it work,
is limited. So if, yeah, it's a good point. Like, of all the folks to proof of concept against, that's a good one. So maybe you have a friend, or maybe it's a CISO, and the CISO is willing to try it out.
Yeah. I'm glad he qualified. What said that executives are fine. Let's appreciate that, Greg.
So is there any, I just want to dig into the privilege management a little bit, or privilege account management or protection. Like, are there recommendations just in general? So let's say you're not ready for UTF or passwordless, but what are some of the recommendations you have for customers that want to just protect their privilege accounts more? Greg, you mentioned password vaults. What are some of the things that people can do that don't have anything to do with FIDO?
The vaulting by itself is extremely recommended by us all the time. Let's get all that in one spot, and then let's set up generally alternative accounts where you're not using privileged accounts as your base account, because that still happens a lot. So that's kind of like table stakes. Let's not give everybody root or, you know, admin access with their typical account that they're working on day in, day out. Then there's the technology is extremely mature these days to be able to use a privilege account or elevate your privileges for a moment in time whenever you need something like an install on your local device, or if you need access to, if you're an administrator, some type of network IT person or whatever, is put that stuff in where you've got timed access. And where now a lot of the companies don't have the maturity to put a lot of that in. So it has to be, there has to be a good process built to say, I need access now to do these things. That's where a lot of the automation work that you can either do within the tools that allow you to do those things, or you go get a SOAR implementation or some kind of orchestration engine that allows you to kick off a workflow. That's kind of that best practice. You need to have a workflow that's got approvals that only gives you access for a certain amount of time. If you can't plan that out well enough to time that, then you need to absolutely have a window where you've got to get this task done in this amount of time, and then it's automatically taken away. And that is either going to be elevating your privileges, or it's going to be giving you access to a whole nother account. And then again, keeping all of those vaulted, and then keeping those, once you use that account and it's done, rotate that password. Then don't keep that password after it's used, because that was another vendor of ours who talked through this, where yes, you can keep those things locked down, but they actually used, I guess, for lack of a better term, ephemeral privileged accounts, where that privileged account was created right then when you needed access, and then was gone. Because if that privileged account is sitting there, even if it's not being able to be used, somebody can get access to it and pop it. That's why I think the middle ground is changing the password after that's used. Even if that's account is sitting there, you've got a strong password, you're doing that right, and you've got it vaulted, then it can be pretty secure. So those are generally some of the best practices that we talk about.
Anything to add on to that one, Greg? Or have you been abusing any of these systems?
I think the ones that are the hardest to go after is the ephemerals. They leave nothing to work with. From a pen tester perspective, if we can get to a machine and a privileged account was used and a number of other things go wrong, we may be able to grab that out of memory. We may be able to grab it in other places. And whether we pass the hash or compromise that account and use it in other places, the least scope means you may go through all this work and maybe you can crack something or not. But if that ends up being useless, you're just burning time. So the ephemerals are really interesting to me and something I don't ever want to have to deal with. But I want organizations to do it, because it does. Don't make the attackers happy.
I can't pop shells. What's going on?
The table stakes around vaulting of this privileged accounts, whether it's the ones who can adjust accounting or the ones who can, you know, turn servers on and off, what can join a domain, all of these kinds of things, rotating those out. It's not so much vaulting. That's important, but that's more of a convenience for administrators to know how to get a password. It's the immediate rotation afterwards that secures it. And then wrapping that around to who's using those accounts, because they are a vector. If a password vault is found in an environment, you better believe an attacker will be spending time trying to figure out how to get into it. Is there anything wrong with it? So it can't be local databases with weak passwords hoping that nobody's going to find them. They have to be strong. The vault itself should be multi-factored as strong as possible. If that's the place where you put the, you know, passphrase and, you know, backup multi-factor, hopefully off of multiple devices or something like that, that's where it should be. You don't have to get to everything, just have to guard the things that matter the most. And the more you can guard, the better. But I don't see wide adoption for the advanced ones. I do think that there's still plenty of organizations that are working on getting to that first step of how do we protect what's most important to us.
Or even discovering, to your point. I often joke that adversaries do a better job of data discovery on our networks than the defenders do, which is painful.
Well, I mean, if we could, maybe that should be a new product where we go attack them and use them for our asset management, because they know more about our environment than we do. One of the things too in the identity and access space, though, in the privileged accounts, is we tend to focus. I'm going to be talking about this in like a zero trust talk in a couple of weeks with Venify, actually, a little event they're putting on, is focus on machine identities, because we forget about machine identities because we're always talking about our identity.
Well, I mean, Lambda is a good example as well. Like Lambda function has permissions and things that it can do.
Absolutely. So people don't, they only think about the user and not the identity, the machine identities and API keys, those kinds of things that just sit out there and get hard coded. I crack up all the time talking about security tools being adding to your attack surface, we'll give a demo and they'll be like, oh man, we're securing all this stuff. And I'm like, well, what about integrations? And I do it one to learn about, do they have good integrations? And two, I want to see how their integrations work. And they're like, oh yeah, we integrate with them and you just stick an API key in here. I'm like, does that ever get rotated? Do you integrate with any kind of vaulting tools? And they look at me with like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, you're adding a single user spot or single place for somebody to grab an API key and do a massive amount of damage to your environment. So how are you rotating this stuff?
Yeah, it's, we, you know, at Digital Shadows, for the set folks that aren't familiar with this, you know, we go out and look at external footprints and we look at GitHub and all the commits on GitHub and some of the things with keys.
Oh gosh.
In fact, if you go back to, was it 2016 when Uber over the summer had an intrusion, that part of that intrusion into AWS was from keys that were on GitHub. So yeah, we see some scary things out on GitHub, GitLab, that people think are private when in fact they're very public, and yep, they're some of the most critical keys and tokens that you could have in the environment. Mm-hmm. Well, let's do this, cause we want to transition maybe a couple thoughts on, next year's planning. What are some of the things that you recommend people do? We're in the planning stages right now, or some folks may be further along than others, but what are good recommendations that you guys would have?
So Craig's going to smile. Everybody that listens to this is going to smile. I'm going to talk about API security again. Greg, are you laughing? I can't see your face. So
yes, he is.
He is laughing. Okay.
He's holding it back though.
I do. This is one area, speaking because I just spoke of the API key sitting out there. I really can't talk about it enough. People are probably rolling their eyes, but I really can't speak about API security enough as something that people need to focus on going into, well, honestly, right now. Like I spoke with a customer not too long ago, and they said that's in my 2023 planning. And I'm like, well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. But one of the things that I talk to them about is making sure, and this happens in a lot of cybersecurity tools that where it's a kind of a new area, is there's big feature gaps that they need to pay attention to in any of those tools when it becomes, like we said before, a feature that needs to be in a product. And there are big feature gaps in API security products, and they need to know which side, they need to actually budget for both of them, whether it's a very security and operations focused tool or whether it's a developer focused tool. And there's nobody that really bridges those gaps. So they need, if they're going to go do API security, that's something they need to look at, is say, I need to get multiple tools right now to help me focus on both sides of the aisle and not just security and operations and discovery. I need to know, developers need to know how strong these APIs are. That's one thing we've been focusing on. You really need to focus on, you know, making sure you know where your APIs are. The other one is identity and access management. There's still a ton of customers that don't, we're not going out there screaming zero trust buzzword. But I don't completely believe that's a buzzword. I think it's a idea and a concept, and identity is core to that. And we're very much focusing on them getting their identity stronger, their access management, and then focusing, moving that into complete governance of identities, because that's, they tend to stop at identity access management and they don't think about identities across their whole infrastructure that starts with their HR system and that kind of thing. How do they manage that? So that's a big focus for us too. There's multiples, but those are probably two of the biggest ones. One very tactical with the API security, one very strategic with identity and access management.
What do you think, Greg?
I think those are very good and very high. From my side, particularly from my role, I think one thing is trying to engage pen tests in a better way. Many, many organizations have to do pen tests, whether it's compliance or they just do them because it's smart. But there are opportunities to use those in better ways of not just do an external or an internal. Think about what those scopes are and think about where industry and kind of common attack vectors are going to be important for your organization, but also not acting out of fear. There's plenty of conversation right after last week, and it's been building for a year of the social engineering pen tests. I think that's interesting. And maybe there's value there, but I think putting pen testers into the environments and having them focus on certain areas of what can you find if you're just sitting on the network, not
just do a lateral
you can't
movement.
Get in.
Just but, start with lateral movement. You're already in.
Yep. Starting from assumed breach, and we've done this in a few places where it's not about can I get in from the outside. It's not can I fish in. It's okay, we're going to start from a workstation that you're going to set up for us. What can I do from there? We're going to start with credentials because, many organizations have figured out how to lock out an attacker from capturing a credentials or getting through the exterior. They've locked out all those ports and put WAFs and all kinds of stuff in place. But if you think that boundary or a perimeter is going to hold, one engagement, one week in the news should be enough to be like, nope, put them in the environment. Let them kind of explore and don't be afraid of the pen testers. They're there to help. They're not adversarial. You know, talk to them about, this is what I'm thinking about. This is what I'd like you to explore. This is how we need to get better. And I would like to probe that. What can you do as an attacker if I set you up this way? Use a pen test to make the organization better. Don't just say, oh, well, they couldn't get in, so we're doing great. There's always something to improve upon. And if we have to do pen tests, we might as well get something useful out of it.
I think that's a really good one. They're going to get in. Anyone can get in. Doesn't matter what the organization is. I could be socially engineered around a barbecue fish and I'd be like, yeah, I'll sign up for that barbecue newsletter from Texas Monthly. And
well, I mean, Dave Maynard said it on Twitter and I kind of played devil's advocate. I think it was last week or week before, but he was like, we should just go ahead and move to assume breach. Forget the social engineering attacks that a lot of pen testers want to do the physical social engineering because that's can be fun.
I love to hear the stories from the consultants that do that work.
The stories are fantastic. And there are people who do it as don't even have cybersecurity expertise. They've got social engineering expertise and they go in there and they plug something in for somebody else to get access to. But I do agree that it's, are you doing it for fun? Are you doing it for lulls? Are you doing it for because you've got to convince your executive management that it is a problem? I do think that is still an issue. But if you can convince them that, hey, let's just go with the assume breach and you don't have to spend as much money on your test, you can just go ahead and start from this point. Maybe that'll convince them. I think we're at that point right now. So yeah, Greg's got a great way of looking at that.
I think for me, for next year, lots of conversation around security solutions. I would recommend everyone talk to your business and find out what they're doing next year and how you might enable that. Actually, here at ReliaQuest, we're going to Utah soon for the leadership team's planning for next year. And we'll hear about some of the business goals and initiatives, and we can think about how do you defend against that. And it could be you're going to roll out a new product and you need to be able to secure that product. It could be you're going to roll business in a new geography and you need to understand the threat landscape of the actors that are operating in South America or South America, top of mind because of lapses. Maybe you're going to operate in Brazil and you need to think about actors in that region. So I would recommend that everyone, you know, try to get clued in on the 2023 planning. The other thing I would say is talk to the risk committee of your organization, public or private. You'll still have some type of risk committee. If you're a public company, you'll have the SEC Form 10-K, which is one of my favorite documents. I talk about it ad nauseum. It'll have 15 to 20 risks in it. And you can look at those risks that the macro business, the big businesses identified, and then you can start mapping out, you know, what are the people, process and technology associated with, you know, if you're a retailer and maybe your loyalty program. And, you know, and that's really important to the organization because we know we get X amount of incremental revenue from loyal customers versus people that aren't in the program. So how do you secure that? So I think taking a top down and bottom up approach is a good way to do it. I think a lot of folks are very focused on, hey, I'm going to roll out new MFA or I'm going to replace my EDR or whatever the case may be. But I think you're missing an opportunity if you don't. You're missing opportunity for yourself also to grow as a security leader in the business because, hey, I'm clued into what the business is doing. I'm thinking about securing that. So I think that's my recommendation for 2023 planning.
Good stuff.
Well, as we wrap up, is there anything, I don't know, Greg, is there anything you want to promote? Are you active on the socials? If people want to learn more about you, is there anything you'd recommend?
I'm active on socials, but I don't post a lot. I kind of push everybody else. So I read a lot of what I can and just try and let people who know more about subjects, pulling those out. So following me is, you know, good way to find like cat animals or cats. And but there's a lot of folks that are working very hard to push information out, and having good conversations when things go bad of now is not the time to panic. So enhance the calm and wait for more information to come through before the hot takes start and things like that. I see so many things, especially on socials, of the need to say, I saw this or I have an opinion about this is so strong right now that we jump in before all the information's out there.
Yeah, the pundits.
Yeah.
And sitting back and watching and figuring out, could an attack be leveraged in my environment or in my customer's environment? And trying to gather that up is kind of what I spend a lot of time doing. And I think it's better than just trying to be popular or generating large followings, because it just restricts things.
I think it's a good point, because you have the InfoSec rock stars on Twitter, but there's plenty of people doing great work that aren't vocal, that aren't content creators. That's what you call it now, I guess.
Not influencer anymore. Mm-hmm.
Well, Michael, you are an influencer. No, so if I want to be influenced by you on socials, where do I go?
So Twitter is M1A1Vet. So you know what that stands for, the M1A1 tank.
You might be the only person that I actually know their Twitter handle without looking it up.
Most people I don't. I've had that for a while. On LinkedIn, if you search, don't search on YouTube for Cyber Sunday, search, because you'll get a bunch of WWE stuff for some reason. Search on LinkedIn for hashtag Cyber Sunday, and I do one of those generally every Sunday, where it's a little 4 or 5 minute talk.
They're good.
Thank you. I appreciate that. They're enjoyable. I just do them for my truck on the way to picking up, or, you know, sitting in the parking lot waiting for dinner to get ready on Sunday night that I pick up and take home. Just little quick thoughts and easily consumable. Then of course, HousecCon, Houston Security Conference, but it's HousecCon. Some people joke and say House Cacon. That's Houston Security Conference. That's coming up in October. Look for that, that site, and it's HoustonSecCon.org is our website if you want to register. And then just generally Ready, Set, Secure, Set Solutions podcast. We're on all the platforms. We've got our YouTube channel where we do these. We do them live generally every couple of weeks. This one we're not doing live, but we do those live as well. And Greg joins me on those, and we have a good time talking to all kinds of different folks. So that's it.
Well, then on our side, our weekly podcast, which gets released on Thursday evenings, is called Shadow Talk. And typically it's a news of the week. So we'll usually take, you know, three stories from the threat landscape, things that are going on there, and then kind of give our perspective. So if you kind of want a quick rundown of the news of the week from an Intel team, that's what we do there. And then for me, I'm on Twitter as Rick H. Holland. Make sure to add that extra H. There's actually a pastor who is Rick Holland, and I see him get added a lot of cybersecurity stuff in there. And then I'm also Rick H. Holland on LinkedIn as well. And I'm pretty active on both of those, but hopefully contributing to the dialogue in a positive way, Greg, and not providing more noise.
We try.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for spending time with us, and feel free to add us on the social media for follow-ups. Take care and stay safe.